This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. I'm Freya Parr, the magazine's digital editor and staff writer, and this week I'm hosting our very first Double Hander podcast episode with the writer Octavia Bright and soprano and composer Eloise Werner. The pair work together as librettist and composer on The Other Side of the Sea, their one-woman opera in which Eloise played the lead role. In this episode, Eloise and Octavia shared their experiences of music over the last year and the role it's played in helping them come to terms with grief and sadness, as well as bringing them huge joy and, more importantly, the opportunity to dance. They spoke to me from their respective flats in London just before society opened back up after the UK lockdown, in that very peculiar limbo period where the world was still slightly in flux. Please excuse the slightly squeaky chair you might be able to hear in this recording. Yet again, the perils of recording from one's unglamorous attic bedroom were definitely realised.
Because this is a podcast about listening, can you both tell me a little bit about where you are and what you can hear on a day-to-day basis? Eloise?
I am in South London, in Brixton, and I live in a flat which is quite badly insulated. So I actually can hear my neighbours quite a lot, but we get on really, really well, so it's totally fine. I can hear, my downstairs neighbours sort of watching TV sometimes and talking to their friends, but that's fine. And I also hear the birds quite a lot because I'm also in a very green area. So that is really lovely.
Octavia? I'm in a flat in North London, and similarly to Eloise, actually, not great insulation, but my upstairs and downstairs neighbours are pretty good. The one thing that's been interesting throughout lockdown is next door is a house, and they have a teenage daughter, and she decided to take up the recorder and also tap dancing during lockdown. So wow. My life has had this like intermittent soundtrack of I have to say she has improved a lot, and she's now graduated from recorder to flute, which is a little bit less invasive. But yeah, it's been pretty wild. That's the struggle. But the good thing is I look out into loads of gardens and there's a lot of wildlife, which is wonderful. Loads of birds as well. Occasionally foxes going at it, which is, a bit of a shock in the middle of the night. But on the whole, it's quite a peaceful place to be, which has been a godsend while we've been spending so much time inside.
Yeah, I feel like everyone suddenly picked up more on the bird song, particularly, I guess, at the height of lockdown when everything was so quiet. There's actually a book that had recently, in fact, actually I've got it here, Birdsong in a Time of Silence.
Oh no, that sounds amazing.
Gorgeous. It's just come out. He's a twitcher and a bird enthusiast, and it's basically all about how the seasons have changed over the last year and the bird song that has kind of underpinned the whole year.
Great.
It's great. Fab. So before we get too carried away talking about music and things like that, we should probably explain to the listeners how you two know each other. So would you like to tell me a little bit about your process of working together?
Eloise, you start.
Okay. So a few years ago, composer Freya Whaley-Cohen wrote a piece of music for my contemporary quartet, the Home Music Experiment. And this piece of music was a beautiful song cycle of the sort of setting of words by Octavia. And so it's a set of three songs, which are actually now available on our new album, if you want to check it out. It's called We Phoenician Sailors. And I just obviously loved it straight away. I loved the words and the music. And when I was thinking of planning a new project, which is a one-woman opera, I was looking for a librettist and someone to work with for the writing side of things, because I'm not good at that at all. And I immediately thought of Octavia, because having just worked together through Freya, I really loved her work. And we met just once in a rehearsal, and I just got a really nice vibe from you. And so I just emailed you and asked you if you'd like to be involved, and you said yes. And that's kind of how our kind of bigger collaboration started and evolved, and we became good friends as well.
Yeah, it was also the most perfect timing, because I just handed in my PhD thesis and was waiting to do my viva, and Eloise's email came in, and I was in that weird state of like, okay, this huge thing is coming to an end. What am I going to do next? Who am I? And then this project landed in my lap, and it was the most beautiful, creative, free experience to sit. And I remember we met in a Pan Quotidien restaurant in down in South London, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In Waterloo, maybe, or something, and sat at the back and just like brainstormed for a couple of hours and drank loads of tea and ate some cakes. And I just thought, this is definitely the right place to be. Like, this is the next thing. This is great.
So had you set words to music before you'd worked with Freya, or was that?
No, I mean, no, not officially. And Freya and I have known each other a very long time. Her older sister, Tamsin, and I went to nursery school together. So I've known her my whole life. And she got in touch with me because she wanted to write some music. She wanted to set poetry to music, and she wanted to write some songs that were looking at sexuality and desire. And she knew that I had been researching and writing about that for a while. And she asked if I had any poetry about desire. And I had this little poem called Oyster, which I sent her, and she loved it. And then she wrote that one piece for the Hermes Experiment. And off the back of that, they commissioned us to write two more. So the first piece was words that I had written separate from music, but the second two in the song cycle I wrote specifically for Freya to set. So that was a really exciting experience to think about how poetry shapes itself differently when you're thinking about it being sung rather than just read, or when you're thinking as well about a particular musician. And Freya's way of composing is really intuitive, and I find it very bold and quite unusual. And so I had a lot of fun thinking about where she might take certain words or certain sounds. And I brought that very much to working with Eloise, because I knew she was a very fearless performer. And that's a gift when you're writing for somebody, when you know that you can take them somewhere really weird and they'll go even further.
So what was, when you started working together on the opera, did you both come with an idea of what it might become? Or obviously, Eloise, you said that you had the one-woman opera in mind. Did you have anything more in terms of like themes or style?
Yeah, I think I had the kind of basic idea of wanting to explore the idea of language and identity, and the relationship between language and performance, and language and identity. I am French and moved to the UK when I was about 18 to study here, and then decided to stay here. And didn't really speak very good English when I moved here first, and now sort of can speak English okay. also a performer, and so I've been thinking a lot about those kind of ideas of what it meant for me to be living in a different country, speaking a different language, and also being a performer myself, and how that kind of translated in my everyday life, and also how it translated on stage, performing words by others and singing words by others. So I kind of approached Octavia with these kind of basic ideas, but then obviously the project developed very much with her and with her ideas as well.
And then what direction did you then take it in, Octavia? What was your process in kind of setting words and as your first time as a librettist?
We started with the ideas, and then I had some snippets of text. I mean, I'm always writing notes to myself and little lines of text and thought. And I had some things. I'd been walking in Cornwall on the Southwest Coastal Path, and I found it a very fertile place to be. And I'd written some lines, and I thought that they could be a really great way in, because I knew when Eloise explained to me the themes that she was interested in, they actually chimed with a place that I was in my own life, having finished the PhD and thinking about my own identity as well. And it felt like a wonderful way to build a bridge between the two of us. And I had these opening lines that were about walking on the Southwest Coastal Path and feeling light and empty because of leaving something behind, but actually the thing that you're carrying is yourself. And so I showed them to Eloise and she really liked them, and we decided that we could start there. And then the rest of it was shaped a lot by, we got funding from Snape Malting. So we went and did a residency down in Aldborough, and we decided that we wanted to bring some of that landscape and that seascape in, and which fit quite well with the opening of the Southwest Coastal Path. So this, we decided we needed to have an anchor in a setting so that we could get more abstract with the ideas and with the sounds. So we kind of brought that, we made a mishmash, I guess, of those two coastal places. And then the more I spoke to Eloise and the more I listened to the way that she enjoys playing in with sound and abstract noise and finding emotional expression in those things, I'd had more of an idea of something with a bit more narrative structure, but actually as we worked together, we both found so much pleasure in just breaking it down and kind of getting somewhere quite strange. And we decided we both really wanted to take some risks with it, because it felt like we were supported in being experimental. And I think when you get a gift of a project like that, you might as well lean into it and take the biggest risk you can, because it's quite rare to be allowed to do that. So then we ended up in a place that was quite different from where I'd imagined and was really, really exciting, where we could get into kind of rhythmic soundings and looking at what happens when you disintegrate, I guess, verbally and also intellectually and emotionally. And then at that point, things were really also influenced by some of our other collaborators. So we were working with Zoe Martlew, who helped us to get, really pushed us to go even further into the abstraction. And we had visuals from Jessie Roger. And so we were also responding to the things that she was picking up on the camera, and it all became really folded into itself. So it started with everyone coming from their individual perspective, but I'd say by the end, it was a totally collaborative project, which was one of the other things that was so wonderful about it.
And Eloise, was that the first opera that you had written in that way?
Yes. I had performed before a one-woman opera as well called Scenes from the End, which again with this, so I came up with the idea and the themes I wanted to explore, but I wasn't comfortable at the stage of just writing the music myself. So I actually worked with a composer, Jonathan Woolgar, who wrote the music and the text actually. And that was a very collaborative process, because I was involved in the making of it, and because it's a one-woman opera as well, you know, a lot of the piece is what I do on stage has so much impact on the piece itself, and some moments were sort of improvised, but it was very much him writing the music and coming up with a basic structure for the piece. And so from the back of that, having performed that and having had that experience of performing an odd solo opera on stage, I then felt like I wanted to take it further and maybe have a go myself at having more freedom with the actual music element of the show. So that's when I came up with this idea of wanting to explore language and identity and performance, and approached Octavia because I definitely didn't want to have to write, well, I cannot write words. So that was not a question. So then thought I needed to a wonderful writer to collaborate with. And so that was my second experience kind of creating a one-woman opera, but definitely the first time being in charge of the musical elements.
Mm, so you came from a kind of performer's perspective. What about you, Octavia? What was your relationship with opera, if at all, anything, before you came across this project?
Well, it was something that my dad and I used to do together. He was a huge opera fan, and he probably once a year would get me tickets to usually the ENO, and he would either come with me or he would send me with my mum or a friend, because he often felt, he would say, oh, I've seen The Marriage of Figaro enough, but, you know, I want you to know it. I want you to understand it. My favourite opera experience was when he took me to see Peter Grimes at the ENO, and it was the most extraordinary performance. It was huge cast, like really amazing sound. And I think that was the first time that I started to see that opera could be something maybe less formal and more experimental than necessarily the classical operas that I'd grown up listening to, and he always had CDs on in the car and stuff. For me, the way the ENO, they would always do really exciting staging and really modern costumes and things like that, which brought it into a space where I think when I was much younger, I had that kind of slightly fearful reverence of opera that people tend to have. And as I got older, I realized it was just as ripe for being messed around with, you know, as any other art form. Which is why I think when Eloise approached me, I was less intimidated than I might have been, you know, years previous. But also, I think I'm a languages student historically, and I speak French not nearly as well as Eloise speaks English, but and I speak Spanish, and I've got some Italian extended family. So there's like also the tradition that opera has of mixing languages and cultures and stuff is something that has always been really, really important to me. And when we started work, we knew that we wanted to bring in that crossover of Eloise's bilingual identity. And I have always wanted to have the chance to play a bit in languages other than English. And that felt true to the opera format, I suppose, in a way, even though we were really messing around with it.
You mentioned that you kind of interacted with opera through your dad. Let's go back. That's quite a good opportunity to kind of go back to our first interactions with music. Eloise, can you tell me a bit about your musical upbringing? Did you grow up in a musical family?
I did, actually. My mum was a baroque flautist, and my dad is a scientist, but he also plays the violin. And my sister now is a filmmaker and scientist, but she also studied the violin when she was younger. And so there was a lot of music in the house all the time. And I started with the cello when I was very young, when I was four. There's a cute picture of me with a tiny cello, and people are like, is this a cello? It looks like a violin, but it's actually a cello. It's the size of the violin, and or maybe a viola. And yes, there was always quite a lot of CDs playing, I suppose. And yeah, my mum, when she was well, she would practice, obviously. So I'd hear music in the house, and also a lot of French songs. Obviously, I grew up in Paris, and there's this tradition, obviously, of wonderful singer-songwriters, French singer-songwriters. So particularly Barbara, who you might know of, and you know, it was always sort of playing at the weekend, and so all this kind of, yeah, I guess there was a lot of that sort of stuff. So not necessarily classical music, but maybe more don't know how you define that genre. It's not really pop, but it's sort of French song, you know, where the words as well are really sort of amazing and heartbreaking. And also, yeah, a lot of Baroque music through my mum. And also, yeah, we always listened to sort of Christmas oratorio around Christmas. And, you know, that was often playing. And because she was playing the flute, she had often parts in those kind of Bach cantatas or passions. And yes, I guess I was very lucky in that way that I had that. And then when I was a teenager, I joined the Maîtrise de Radio France, which is the French radio children's choir. And so I was really lucky, and so did my sister, actually. We both joined at the same time. I was a bit older when I joined. And that was amazing. Basically, it's part of the French radio. So it's the children's choir, part of the French radio. And we had school every morning, like every other children. So normal schooling with all the hours kind of packed in the morning from Monday till Saturday. And then every afternoon we'd have choir, music lessons, composition. But yeah, a lot of choir essentially. And we did some stage productions as well and performed in the most amazing concert halls in Paris and elsewhere. We went on tour, and essentially it was amazing because we were the kind of choir associated with the radio. Anytime, you know, an orchestra needs a children's choir for a piece, that would be us. So we'd do recordings with the most amazing conductors as well. So that was an amazing experience. And I did that basically throughout my teenage years. And that was a hugely formative time for me.
And nowadays you're kind of one of the rare breeds that have managed to coincide being a singer and a composer kind of to equal levels. When did you first start writing, and did that interact with your singing as well?
Yes. Well, I think, when I was at the Maîtrise, that was the amazing thing, is that we had such a broad musical education. So we'd sing every day in choir and also had, you know, individual singing lessons, but also composition lessons. And I always loved writing, and I always took part in the composition competitions and things, and won a few, and then the choir would perform my pieces. And so it was already kind of, I guess when I think about it now, the composition and the singing was actually quite linked early on, thanks to the opportunities that I was given then. And I also, when I was a teenager, I'd write songs that I would perform singing at the piano, accompanying myself at the piano, kind of a bit like Barbara style, so quite lush harmonies. And my sister wrote the words for me because I couldn't write words still at that time. and that, you know, I did that a lot, and it was a very natural thing for me. And it kind of evolved from, you know, then obviously then I trained properly as a singer, and but still kind of was writing on the side. And more recently, I've really started composing more again, and also started composing for other performers now, which is exciting. But yeah, I think the kind of performing and composing was always quite linked from quite early on through singing. Yeah.
And do you remember the first piece of music, or any, you mentioned Barbara, but is there any particular piece of classical music that you remember first coming across and falling in love with that has kind of cemented in your brain?
Yes, I think there's loads, actually, and it's hard to maybe pinpoint the first one, but one of the first pieces that I really remember vividly and I still listen to a lot is the Violin Concerto by Mendelssohn. There's this moment in the first movement after the kind of cadenza, the violin cadenza, where the orchestra joins back in underneath the violin, kind of with the main theme, and the violin sort of plays broken kind of arpeggios on top of the orchestra. And it's so beautiful and amazing. It's like magic, because that moment where you think, wow. When first hearing it, you know, I just got moved so much. It's that kind of thing that music can do. You can't really put it into words, but it feels so good and it's so nice to listen to, and it just moves you. It's just a wonderful feeling. And it's quite a simple thing. And like the kind of way Mendelssohn did that is quite a simple way of writing it, but it just works so well. And that's, I remember thinking, well, music is amazing. You know, you could just kind of create this kind of trigger, those kind of emotions by just simply writing this beautiful melody and kind of the violin on top with these chords. And yeah, it's just, I remember, and I still listen to that movement a lot, you know, because it just still does the same effect to me than it did some time ago when I first heard it.
And that's a piece as well that's been recorded and performed time and time again. Are there any recordings that you particularly return to or find comfort in?
Yeah, so there's the recording of Menuhin playing it with Ford Wangler conducting. And there's this thing with Menuhin's sound. I don't know, you kind of hear it and straight away you know it. It's him playing, and you know, it's so warm, and it kind of gets straight to your, I don't know what part of your body, but it's just like, wow. And it's very kind of generous and direct, and it's so special. So yeah, that recording, when I hear it, I know it's that recording straight away, with the orchestra comes in with, yeah.
And Octavia, same question to you, really. Is there a piece of music that you first remember coming across, and in what context did you first discover music?
My context was also in my family. My dad also actually was a scientist before he became a kind of head of industry, and he always played music the whole way through. So he was a wonderful pianist, and he also played the clarinet, and he decided not to pursue that as a career. But he always kept it going, and he always wanted me to be brought up in a house full of music. He had great hopes that I would also be a talented musical person, and I really, really let him down on that one. I had piano lessons and singing lessons until I was, I guess, GCSE level, when we all realized that it just wasn't my natural form of expression. But the thing that was a wonderful gift for that is that I've always had a real appreciation of music. And the house for me when I was a kid was always full of music, mainly classical and then jazz. My dad was a big jazz fan as well, and we used to play jazz piano together, which was a really beautiful memory. But I guess the piece that stands out for me that I can have, I have a very vivid memory of listening to it as a small child, because again, like Eloise, I find it very hard to say which was the first ever one, but this was from the ballet, Prokofiev's ballet of Romeo and Juliet, and it's the piece The Montagues and Capulets, because it's so intensely dramatic, and I have a very clear memory of parading around my family's house, I think with a sarong tied around my shoulders as though I was wearing a like queenly cape and imagining that I was Lady Capulet. The thing I responded to as a child in classical music was storytelling. And the ballets often have the most extraordinary storytelling in the music. And obviously the opera is in a different way, but where you've got no libretto, just the way that ballet tells the story of all the different characters through the sounds and the style, you know, and you know from that piece, the Montagues and Capulets, that they have beef and there's trouble and they're big characters. And every time I hear that piece of music, I'm taken back to a time of being very young and very interested in like big emotions. I mean, that hasn't changed.
Do you think that either of you have learnt about, I guess probably Octavia, this question more applies to you, have you learned anything about storytelling from opera and ballet in terms of your own approach to writing?
That's such a good question. I think Yes, I think so, you know, because the thing that you find in ballets and operas is, you know, you have refrains that come back and announce particular characters or that draw your attention to a particular tone in the story, whether that's this is a time when people are feeling love or this is a time when people are feeling anger. And I think that's definitely something that comes into my creative writing. I wish I could have done my academic writing like a ballet. That would have been so joyful. But I do think that there is something, if you grow up surrounded by storytelling in music, some of it's very unsubtle, right? Like some of it's very, very top level, but there is a subtlety to it. And I think you get a real sense of the shape of a story and how, you know, a good story holds your attention partly by giving you nuggets of things that you can hold on to as it unravels. And I think this idea of a particular refrain that comes back, however subtly, is a really helpful thing if you're trying to follow something. And I think it definitely gives you a sense that you can be quite abstract in storytelling and it still be very clear to the person who's watching it. I mean, I think I wouldn't claim to have like cracked that one yet, but I think it's a good goal.
Work in progress.
yeah, exactly.
So when you first heard the Montagues and Capulets, did you see that in a live context or did you just hear it on a record or at home and have it explained to you?
I think it would have been, I would have heard it on a record at home first and then was taken to the ballet. I was very lucky to be taken to the ballet quite often as a child and I loved dance and did ballet classes and all that, you know, Angelina ballerina style stuff. But I would have, at that age, it would have just been playing at home. Which is an interesting thought, actually. So yes, I would have had the story told to me. I think also Romeo and Juliet, it's such a, I grew up in a house with lots of literature and people always talking about stories and things. So I probably had a sense of it long before I ever saw even, you know, the play, let alone the ballet.
Mm. Yeah, that is, I think you're right in a lot of people, ballet and particularly ballet, actually, people come to those stories of Romeo and Juliet or Swan Lake or anything like that through ballet and then end up kind of realizing the other way around that they exist as stories. I remember I came across Swan Lake through Barbie Swan Lake.
Perfect.
So I wanted to ask you both a little bit about live performance because it's such a big part of the musical world that has obviously been slightly halted in the last year. Eloise, in normal times, do you experience, obviously you experience live music on the stage all the time, but how much live music are you able to see in person?
A lot. I always try and, if I have a free evening and I'm not too tired and there's something going on that I want to see, I tend to go and try and see it if I'm able to. So I was always sort of out and about, either watching a concert or a play as well. I love going to the theatre as much as live music, actually. And that's something that I've really missed. And I, you know, whenever there's been in the last year any opportunities to go and see something live, because there were a few windows where there were, you know, a concert, you know, I've been to that one. I found that A, it just gives me so much joy to just watch live performance, but also for my work. I know I learn so much from watching others, and it's such a big part of how you kind of create is just learning from other live performances that are going on. And also it's kind of showing your support, and often, you know, you kind of know the people involved or you want to be there and support them. And I found that it's been quite difficult to, yeah, all of this just not happened. And just the idea of, just waiting for it to come back, really. And hopefully it will. I mean, it's looking like it will come back slowly. And obviously things might be social distance for a while and that kind of thing. But I definitely normally go and see a lot of live performances, and that's something that I've definitely hugely missed in this last year.
How has your listening changed with the restrictions on live performance? Have you, because I know a lot of instrumentalists and artists for the first months or so kind of retreated away from music. It was a bit too hard to engage with it. How did you find in terms of your listening and your rehearsals as well, I guess?
Yes, I think it sort of evolved because obviously at the beginning when it was the very first lockdown and everything was shut, I sort of went into this weird rabbit hole of doing Corona solfège. So that, which for those listeners who might not know what it is, because why would you? It's a weird thing that I sort of invented and created and sort of did mini compositions using my face and my voice and my teeth and my eyes. So I sort of weirdly went into that quite early on in the first lockdown and did that solidly for quite a few weeks, you know, so I wasn't really engaging, but there was not much to engage with in the outside world. And I guess at that time I didn't really listen to a lot of music, I guess. But I still, you know, listened to a lot of Nina Simone, I remember at the time. And when I would go for walks in the park, you know, I often have my headphones on and listen to perhaps not necessarily classical music, but I remember, yeah, having a big Nina Simone phase quite early on. And I don't know, it felt right at the time to listen to those kind of songs and those kind of really powerful words. And then I guess as time went on, Corona Solfège sort of became a bit more spread out and I wasn't just crazy and doing that all day. And I guess, yeah, maybe started listening to other music more. And of course, then more and more online things were happening as well and more live stream concerts. So I've been kind of watching those more and more and engaging more with things that were sort of going on more as the sort of lockdown eased and things like that. But I think I wasn't like, you know, completely like, no, I don't want to hear about music anymore. I think it's just because I sort of did this Corona Solfège thing, I went into a rabbit hole, which kind of kept me quite busy. And so I you know, I was doing that. And then once I'd spent all day just working out these rhythms, I maybe didn't really want to listen to more music. But it wasn't necessarily a kind of conscious thing of like, I can't listen to music at the moment. So it was just sort of how it happened at the time.
What was it about artists like, you mentioned Nina Simone there, what was it about artists like her that, because that, she's actually weirdly quite a common name that keeps cropping up with who people are listening to in lockdown. Why did she appeal to you at that time?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously as artists, you always kind of think, you know, what am I doing in this world and what is it that I want to say and bring and what sort of legacy do I want to leave? You know, what is it that, why do I do what I do and what do I want to say and what do I want people to feel and what do I want to transmit? And obviously Nina Simone is like a huge inspiration because obviously she was an activist and like all her music was kind of, her art was, had a definite kind of aim. And she, you know, in her songs, she says kind of, you will hear these words, you know, she left this huge legacy and obviously changed the world with her music and her songs and her performances. And so, I mean, that's hugely inspiring. And in a time like now, when, of course, especially, yeah, it's really tough time for so many, for all of us and for some people more than others. And you think, well, what can I do now with my art that might help people in this time? And perhaps leave something behind as well. And so, I mean, I guess with the Corona Solfège thing, it's kind of, I had this idea of, you know, I want to cheer people up and to create something uplifting in this really tricky time that we are going through. And perhaps doing this will somehow, like, you know, lift people's spirits for 1 minute a day if they scroll past it on their feeds. That kind of was the idea. And, you know, you kind of think, and Nina Simone, I mean, yeah, her the legacy she left behind is absolutely enormous and so inspiring. And it's so, her words and it's so direct. And it's, you know, she just, at the time, she just did it. I mean, we can't really imagine this time now because things have changed so much. But, you know, she went out there and sang these songs to the people and for the people. And so I guess that definitely resonated with me on a, obviously, much like a different scale. I'm not saying I'm Nina Simone at all, but she was definitely like somewhere up there that I thought, wow, you did this at this time. And you kind of think, well, is there something that I also can contribute to in a very, very small way?
That's so beautifully put. I think that really captures exactly why everyone's turned to her in times of slight hopelessness and everyone's very frazzled. What about you, Octavia? What have you been turning to and retreating to musically over the last year?
It's changed quite a lot. It's been a bit of an evolution, I think. Mm-hmm. At first, I wasn't really listening to music at all. I think I just shut down a bit and found it. I'm a very emotional listener of music, and I find it, you know, like a lot of people, very, very penetrating. And so there are times when I'm almost too raw to risk it, because it can take me somewhere very intense, you know. And there's a certain kind of the way that music and memory relate to one another and things. It's one of the great joys of music that it can be so transporting, but sometimes I find that quite unnerving. And so I think at the beginning I was just in a state of kind of high anxiety and numbing. I wanted to numb myself. So I was, you know, listening to a lot of radio and podcasts and just filling my head with the voices of other people, which was a nice way to do it. And then once I adjusted, I started to be able to seek joy again. And really, I just listened to funk and soul. And like Shuggy Otis and Sly and the Family Stone. Like I wanted joy. I wanted to dance, which I did a lot of at home in my sitting room. All my neighbors on the opposite side of the street probably could see. And that was just how it was. I think you have to, right? And you realize that you're just not like, you know, when life is more normal, I go dancing as often as I possibly can. And like, it's a really important part of my relationship to music is moving my body to music and like giving myself over to that experience of it. And I think the majority of the live music I see is music that I can dance to. And I've found the loss of that really massive in my life. And it, you know, you can get there on your own, but it's not the same as being surrounded by other bodies also moving in time to the beat. And, you know, the physicality, I've always been fascinated by the physicality of musicians and their relationship to music, which is obviously so channeled deeply through their body. And when you have that experience of live music where you're watching the musicians as these incredible physical vessels for the sound and you're able to respond with your own physicality, and it's this alchemic, amazing kind of communal coming together. And that I've missed desperately. Recently, I've started listening to a lot of Megan Thee Stallion, which is great. She's a powerhouse. But then the other thing, which, you know, I very sadly lost my father to COVID and had to put together music for his funeral. And that was a really, really extraordinary privilege, actually, because music was such a big part of his life. And it was this incredibly special way of connecting with him. And it meant that I had to go back into a lot of the classical music I used to listen to when I was younger and stuff that I find very moving and maybe was a bit wary of touching. And actually, of course, the lesson was it's always wonderful. Mm. And so I've been listening to a lot Mozart's Clarinet Concerto in A Major, K622. I never know how you say the title of that, because it sounds so unromantic, right, with all those
it
letters
really
and
is.
Numbers. Yeah, but it's this deeply optimistic piece of music and very gentle and loving, I find. And so that, since then, which was in January now, I've been listening to that a lot and feeling, again, a very different relationship. Like my relationship to classical music when I'm listening is not physical at all. It's very cerebral, actually. And I've been letting it take me, you know, backwards in time and with the spring happening at the same time, it's been a kind of wonderful double movement, you know, like thinking optimistically about what's on the horizon for all of us and more freedom coming and more kind of liberation. And then also letting this music take me back into myself and into my memories. And it's a real gift. mean, I don't need to say that to you guys, but it's like, it's yeah, I think it's easy to forget quite how magical the arts are in their different ways and what they're capable of bringing to your life.
I totally agree. And I also thought when I sent over the questions in advance to you about your specific musical choices, weirdly, both of your choices seem to follow along fairly similar lines. Like, you know, the music that your best live performance, you both pick like super, super vibrant, very, like you say, like full bodied performances. And then what you're listening to at the moment followed across more traditional classical lines. Like, tell me a bit about that. Heloise, what are you listening to at the moment? What is occupying your mind in that way?
I think similarly as Octavia said, you know, that the way that music can really trigger memories is really amazing, and how you associate certain pieces of music with a specific time in your life or a specific person or, you know, a specific place. And I think in a time like this where we sort of don't quite know what's going on, and although things look maybe now more optimistic, but it feels quite, even sometimes if it is quite painful to do, but it's quite a special feeling to kind of go back in certain places in the past and kind of relive older memories of things you used to be able to do, you can't do now, or people you haven't seen in a long time, or people you haven't seen because they're passed away. And I think music has this amazing ability to transport you like this. And of course, if you live on your own, well, I do live on my own. And so, even like if you're in the lockdown, you don't see many people, you don't hear that much sound, but hearing kind of music, like sound in your ear, straight in your ear, kind of provides that kind of bridge and kind of gets you to, even if it's in your head, like a place or a person. I guess for me, I mean, I always go back to Bach all the time, and so many different for so many different reasons. I guess one reason is that I have a very special connection to Bach because my mum was a Baroque flautist, and she played a lot of Bach when I was young, and she passed away now 10 years ago. But I found that, especially in this time, and I don't know if it's kind of because things are quite emotional, but you kind of, it's a kind of time of reflection, and you sort of have maybe more time to also just pause and just kind of think about what's happened until now and where I got to. And so listening to a lot of Bach kind of makes me very calm, but also just kind of opens my mind to these like quite vivid memories and images. And so, I mean, especially, I guess, also at the moment, because Easter is coming up, everyone's kind of talking about Bach, and people are kind of recording Matthew Passions and John Passions and things like that. And when things were normal before the pandemic hit, I used to kind of take part in those things a little bit as well. So it's quite a nice time now to kind of just listen to the Matthew Passion or the John Passion and get into that sort of amazing sound world. And I associate it so vividly with those sort of memories. A lot of the solo violin, Bach partitas and solo cellos as well. There's something very, I don't know, very magical and very open about it. So I guess I've played that a lot on my phone. And also similarly, as we mentioned before, I also tend to dance in my flat quite a lot. And for that, I listen to sort of 80s sort of hit. So I just literally go on Spotify and find a hit. You know, there's lots of playlists called 80s hits or whatever, and I just put that on and I just dance to that. Or even when I go to the park, you know, I put my headphones on and I just listen to any old sort of uplifting 80s hit. I guess like Octavia said, like with the Mozart concerto, there's kind of really amazingly beautiful pieces that have quite clear associations with the past, and also kind of putting on sort of groovy beats and just going along with that, and you feel like it gives you some sort of energy to sort of move forward somehow.
Tell me a little bit more about these the best live performances you've ever seen, because you both sent what sound like absolutely unreal performances and made me incredibly nostalgic for going out to New Orleans. Octavia, can you tell me about that?
Yeah, oh my gosh, it's one of my favorite best musical memories. I was there, it was when I was doing my PhD. I was in New Orleans for a week to give a paper at a conference, and it was one of these, like, the big highs of my academic career. I couldn't believe that this was being made possible. And I didn't know anyone there, but someone put me in touch with a friend who was living there. She was working for a charity called Reprieve that tries to help people who are on death row. She'd been there for a year. And so I got in touch with her and said, look, I'm in town, you know, if you'd like to show me the ropes or whatever. And she said, well, listen, there's this massive New Orleans tradition happening at the weekend called the Second Line. You probably don't know what it is. I'm not going to tell you anything more. Just come and meet me on the corner of this street and this street at this time, and we'll have a great time. And I was like, cool. I, by that point, had completed all of my academic responsibilities and I was ready to kind of enjoy the city. And it was extraordinary. So the Second Line is an old New Orleans tradition that has a really, really rich and complex history that I kind of won't go into because it's very long, but essentially it's to do with the jazz funerals that are a big part of the culture there. And the family and kind of chief mourners would be the first line, and they would walk behind the coffin. And then the second line would be the community, and always would involve a jazz band or a brass band of some kind. But now there is a weekly second line in particular neighborhoods in New Orleans. So not necessarily related to a funeral. It's just a street party. And there will be these incredible bands, and everyone in the neighborhood comes out and tailgates and has beers off the back of their cars. And all the grannies come out on their porches. And these amazing, like, incredible dudes on bareback riding horses come, and people bring out their muscle cars. And it's just like, for this, like, you know, little English girl, it was absolutely extraordinary. And the band were Rebirth, who, you know, you may have heard of because they kind of shot to international recognition when there was that TV series Tremé made in the wake of Hurricane Katrina that was all about this district in New Orleans called Tremé. And Rebirth did the theme song, and they were all in it. And they are the most extraordinary musicians. These guys, it's a brass band, all the different brass instruments, you know, from the massive sousaphones to everything else. And they wear these incredible outfits, and the songs they play, it's just this explosion of joy and you know, historical tradition. It's so generous and so incredibly welcoming. And you experience this communal ritualistic thing, and you walk the second line. So you're all in motion. You walk through the neighborhood for several hours, and the music is just continuous, continuous, continuous. And you dance and you talk to everybody. And it's a very unique experience that couldn't be replicated in a concert hall or a gig venue. You know, it's all about being on the streets and being outside. I grew up in West London, and I grew up sort of participating in Notting Hill Carnival as a child. And so it felt at once quite familiar to me, that kind of street party of a particular sort, and then also totally new and enlightening and exciting. But yeah, I listen to Rebirth quite a lot because it takes me right back to that moment. And I can remember the sounds and the smells, like the smells of everyone's kind of barbecue and cooking, and the taste of beer and like everything. It's a really sensory experience. And then, yeah, that's one of the ones that really, really stands out, I guess, because it couldn't have been any different from exactly how it was, you know, those moments in time. Whenever I experience something like that, I'm reminded of how kind of buttoned up and serious daily life can be in this country, and yeah, what a shame that is.
We need more carnival atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Eloise, tell me about yours, because speaking of carnivals, yours was in Rio, which is obviously the home of carnivals.
Yeah, it's true. Yes, I was about, I think, 16 or 17, and I was really lucky to spend 10 days in Rio, and I was there with my dad, because he was working there, and my sister. And so he had quite a lot of colleagues and friends and some of his students as well there, kind of knowing the city and kind of recommending nice things to do in the evenings. And so one night we were recommended to go into this bar, and I walked in, and it was just this, you know, it was a just fairly standard small bar in Rio. And there was this incredible band playing with this just stunning singer called Teresa Cristina. And I was just completely blown away. And I guess I'd never seen anything quite like it, and still haven't since then, actually. it was just, you know, when you just see an amazing performance on every level, the musicianship is just so amazing. So all the musicians are so tight rhythmically. They obviously don't have any sheet music or anything. It's all, you know, coming out of their brains and bodies, and just the kind of rhythmic tightness of it and the sort of virtuosity. And she has a beautiful kind of, again, very emotional voice. And even though I didn't understand what she was, you know, singing about, because obviously it was in my language, but I could get all these like emotions and kind of stories, kind of, I could get sort of what she was sort of singing about just through her incredible performance. And I was just completely blown away. And it was quite nice, because a few years ago I did, so obviously at the time, you know, I was quite shy maybe, and, you know, or, you know, if it was now, I would have just gone up to them after and be like, oh, you know, great, like, can we be in touch? But obviously at the time, you know, I just didn't think that was something you could sort of do, I guess. And I didn't take their numbers or didn't stay in touch at all. But then recently I was asked to take part in this podcast for Jess Gillam's podcast, This Classical Life, on Radio 3, and you have to pick some of your favourite music. And I pick one of her tracks, so it's her and her band. And and then basically I let her know through just following her on Twitter and like sending her, I send her a DM on Twitter being like, hello, this is quite weird and stalky, but I saw you, you know, when I was 16 in this bar in Rio. And, you know, I'd kind of never thought she's quite, you know, quite a big time now, actually. Well, probably already at the time, but obviously I didn't realise, but, you know, she's quite huge there. And she followed me back and replied to me. And said, oh, it's so lovely, you know, thank you so much. I'll tune in and, you know, please, when you next come to Rio, like, let's meet up and do something, you know. And so I was just like, this is kind of amazing, kind of, you know, Twitter has this, you know, can be terrible in so many ways, but this kind of through the internet, and obviously someone on the other side of the world that I hadn't, you know, I never spoke to before, but I'd seen live, and now I chose her track for this show. And hopefully, if I can ever go to Rio, you know, fingers crossed in the future, if, you know, I definitely want to meet her and like have a chat with her, and perhaps even like, I don't know, do a collaboration of some sort. And that would be really amazing, because it really just stayed with me, that performance. And and so actually in the lockdown I have still also, I regularly listen to her music, because it is incredibly, it's a very warm feeling and it's very groovy. Again, it's just so uplifting and but at the same time very kind of soulful and moving at the same time. It's really incredible. So I really, really recommend listening to her and her band.
Both of you, tell me a bit about what you've been listening to over the last year. Just to kind of bring it up to the current day, how does listening fit into your lives? Obviously, Octavia, I imagine a lot of your working life revolves around reading and writing. Do you listen to music while you do that?
No, I have to be very silent, actually. It depends a little bit. Writing, no, I'm best off in silence, or in somewhere with lots of ambient noise, like a cafe, and then music is fine. But I think just because I have such an emotional and penetrating relationship with music, I don't do well ignoring it. If it's on, I'm listening. And if I'm listening, I'm not necessarily thinking, you know? But what I will do is if I'm writing something where I want to get into a particular mood in order to write it, parts of my practice will be listening to music first in order to create that environment for myself. Or, you know, if I'm at the moment, I'm writing some stuff that's kind of memoir, I guess, and I'm trying to create a particular sense in the writing, and the music won't make its way in, partly also because it's actually impossible to have like lyrics and songs mentioned in books, because it costs so much money for the copyright. But I'll have a particular image. So at the moment I've got this amazing painting by Georgia O'Keeffe of a skull against a blue sky, and then I'll have a particular piece of music and I'll spend some time with the image and the song first, and then I'll go into the writing. So it's very much a part of the practice, but it's not happening at the same time. And if I'm reading for work, I need silence really to be able to take it all in, because if I'm preparing for an interview, I want to have it all right at the front of my mind. But I think that's one of the reasons I miss cafes so much, because I miss having that option for that kind of ambient sound. And sometimes when I'm in a cafe and they're playing really, really excellent music, but it's at enough of a distance, there's a barrier with all the chatter that means it doesn't overwhelm me, but it can be a gift, you know, it can be like a wonderful moment of inspiration that comes if you suddenly hear a song that you forgot about, or, you know, new music as well. But yeah, I wish I was someone who could do both at once, but I'm just not.
I read something so beautiful recently. I can't even remember where I read it, but it was all about the loss of cafes as a kind of third space. So it's not work, it's not home, but it's this like beautiful in between that you can connect to individual sounds, but they're not totally in your periphery.
Yeah. And it's out of your control. I think that's the thing I'm missing so much. I'm missing things being able to have an effect on me that I didn't seek out or I didn't choose, you know. So much of that, the joy of life is in those incidental things.
And before I let you both go, I have one final question. Are there any artists or composers that you've been enjoying recently that have kind of captured your imagination in some way, either from the classical canon or beyond? Octavia?
I've been listening quite obsessively, actually, to Beverley Glenn Copeland, who a friend recommended to me a few months ago, and I'd never heard of him before. And what a gift, honestly. His music is so varied. I mean, he's been in the game quite a long time, but he's risen to prominence at this slightly later stage in his career. And his voice is like nothing I've ever heard before. It's really otherworldly and at the same time, absolutely precise in how it explores emotion. It's really, really, really special. And I would recommend starting with the album Transmissions, which is a career retrospective, essentially. So you really get a sense of the scope of his talent and his influences. And he's a musician who's absorbed influences from all over the musical canon, and has explored different styles at different stages of his performing career. And so it's an album that really takes you on a bit of a journey through all of that stuff. But it's very emotional. I mean, it's definitely the kind of music that some of my friends do put it on in the background. For me, I find it incredibly demanding of my attention, because it's going to take me somewhere really, really exciting, but sometimes a bit challenging. Not that the music is challenging to listen to, but just that it's so intimate, I guess, is the way to say it. I find the music very, very intimate, and I find it's very, at times reflective, at times incredibly uplifting, almost euphoric, because he goes to these great emotional heights just with his voice. Really, really magic. And I think because he had this kind of career renaissance in this last year, I think his voice is going to be one that a lot of people associate with this time of restriction and kind of internal reflection. And I think in a way, he's the perfect musician for this moment, because he creates entire worlds, you know, in every track. So it's good to be listening to when you can't be elsewhere and you can just follow him on this imaginative trip, basically.
Gorgeous, that sounds great. Are there any tracks that you'd particularly recommend of his?
Oh, I don't know. That's such a... no, I think just go with the album. I think basically because they're quite varied. Yeah. I think they'll speak to you. I mean, I find they speak to me, different tracks speak to me at different times, at different feet, when I'm in different emotional states. I warn you, you will probably weep at times. And
wouldn't be a change for a day of lockdown.
Well, right, exactly. And it can be that glorious catharsis. And I think one of the things I find so special about him is like he holds you in the song while you cry or while you feel the deep feeling. He doesn't abandon you, you know, in the music.
I think one artist I just keep thinking about and coming back to, and she's also a friend of mine, she's Erilyn Wallen, who's just a queen. It's just incredible how prolific she is all the time, and she writes amazing music, and so she's both a composer and a performer as well, so I really relate to that as well. And what I love about her is, well, firstly, she's just a wonderful human being, and she's so funny, and she's so generous and so supportive, and she's been very good to me as well, kind of supporting my work and helping me kind of develop as an artist. So she's sort of mentor for me. But also, she just writes the music she wants to write, and you know, she has had big commission from the Proms, and she writes these big orchestral pieces. But she also sits at the piano and writes songs, and so she doesn't have kind of one style, which I think is so amazing. I mean, she can go from, I mean, if you go online, there's on YouTube, for instance, you can find a lot of the songs she wrote when she was young. So it's her kind of playing and singing, accompanying herself. And she has a beautiful voice as well. And the style of those songs is very different from the sort of orchestral music she writes, and is very different from maybe her chamber music as well. And so she's just, really wide range of music, which, and I love everything that she writes. And she's just a very inspiring person, and she lives in this lighthouse at the top of Scotland. I've been to, it's the most incredible place. It looks onto the sea and the mountains. I mean, it's just completely idyllic.
If I was to put both of you on the spot and to ask what the last track that you listened to on your streaming platform of choice was, what would it be?
Mine is Body by Megan Thee Stallion.
Great.
I just think she's so rad. Performer I would absolutely like lie down in the street to see play live. I think she would give the most amazing stage show.
I agree.
Mine is Sweet Dreams.
Nice.
Great track.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That was Octavia Bright and Eloise Werner talking to me from their homes in London. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think of the podcast by rating and reviewing wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thanks to Acast for hosting, and Brittany Colley for production.